From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. The World Health Organization has declared the ongoing Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo a global health emergency. Over the past year, more than 2,500 people have been infected and close to 1,700 have died. It is the second deadliest Ebola outbreak ever. And on top of deaths from the virus, aid workers have been killed by armed attackers. But the leader of the World Health Organization says the fact that the outbreak hasn't been worse is a testament to both health workers and biomedical researchers. More than 160,000 people have been vaccinated using vaccines that didn't exist during the last outbreak, and specific treatments for the disease are also being tested. Anthony Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the federal agency where much of the development of Ebola vaccines and treatments is happening. Dr. Fauci, welcome back to Living Lab Radio.
It's good to be with you.
Let's start with vaccines. Research on vaccines was fast-tracked toward the end of the last Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Early studies showed that the vaccines seem to be incredibly effective, and now, of course, they're actually in use. Are these already fully approved? How fast-tracked was this research?
Well, certainly it was fast-tracked because we were, you know, going through it as the outbreak was going on. And that's really one of the things that's relatively unique, that you don't have a vaccine ready to go in whatever particular outbreak you're dealing with. So the trial that was done was a strongly suggestive of there being efficacy. But the design of the trial, which was a ring vaccination trial, was not your classical randomized placebo-controlled trial, which would relatively quickly give you a definitive determination of efficacy that would allow for approval.
And what is a ring vaccination study?
A ring vaccination study is one that was modeled against what we classically did decades and decades ago with smallpox, where instead of vaccinating the entire population, that you identify someone who is infected and you vaccinate the contacts of that person and the contacts of those contacts. So you essentially put a metaphorical ring around the index case. That was the design of the trial that was done in West Africa, actually in Guinea, a few years ago, which strongly suggested efficacy. The process of putting the candidate into full approval is on its way. I can't really predict exactly when that will be happening, but it's really on a pathway to getting approved.
Despite not being fully approved yet, it is still, though, in use, and they're using it essentially, as you were describing, this ring vaccination, not trying to hit
right.
Everyone in the Democratic Republic of Congo, but trying to get those most at risk. Often when we think about just like the flu vaccine or any other vaccine, you know, the advice we're given is that you need to actually have the vaccine well before you are exposed to the disease. How does the ring vaccination work in an active outbreak? I mean, how effective is it? Or it does it seem to be, based on the data that we're getting from this outbreak, when you're giving it to people who may already have been exposed to Ebola?
Well, a couple of things. You're talking about the context of the context. So the incubation period is generally a couple of weeks, anywhere from 2 to 21 days for Ebola. The vaccine needs at least 10 days and hopefully 14 days to be able to induce some degree of protection based on what we know from animal studies and from the immunogenicity.
So this is really a race, right, between how long ago was someone exposed? You need almost 2 weeks for the vaccine, maybe up to 3 weeks for the disease to develop. I mean, that's a pretty tight timeline.
It is. And that's exactly why there's a lot of tension and a lot of important work going on to try and keep up. One of the somewhat, if not considerably, disturbing aspects of what's going on right now in the Democratic Republic of the Congo is that a substantial proportion, sometimes more than 50% of the cases that are coming in were not identified among, quote, contacts. Mm-hmm. So these are individuals who've gotten infected, but you really don't know what the source of infection is. That's troublesome because that means we don't have our arms around the outbreak the way you wish you would, where you've essentially identified all the contacts.
In the long term, would it be possible to use the vaccines that have been developed at this point to actually do childhood vaccinations and eliminate the risk of Ebola for those who have been vaccinated? Would it work long term?
Well, that's a very good question. The durability of the protection has not yet been fully established. But right now we're dealing with an acute situation, and that is less relevant now, but will become relevant under the scenario that you are suggesting, namely some time in the future when you really want to do a population-based vaccination.
Well, Anthony Fauci, the other line of research that's been going on is trying to develop treatments. And of course, during the last major outbreak in West Africa, what we heard repeatedly is we really don't have a treatment for this disease. We can provide fluids and supportive measures. But now there are actual specific medications that are being developed for, I believe, that are being tested. How do those work? What are they trying to do for patients to fight this disease?
Well, right now there are four therapeutic modalities that are being tested in a randomized controlled trial. One of these, called ZMAP, which is a combination of three monoclonal antibodies directed against Ebola, was tested actually in West Africa, in Liberia, in a randomized placebo-controlled trial that showed a strong hint of efficacy, but was not past the cutoff of statistical significance. So it was suggestive, but not definitive.
And a cocktail of antibodies sounds like it's essentially shortcutting the vaccination stage, not waiting for your body to take 10 days to 14 days to produce antibodies, just giving you an immune response immediately.
That's exactly right. So right now, what's going on in the Democratic Republic of the Congo is a randomized controlled trial in which the control is ZMAP because of its strong suggestion, but not definitive proof of efficacy. And that's being tested against three other interventions. So there are four therapeutics that are now in trial. The trial would require about 545 people in the trial. We're close to that full accrual now. So hopefully within a reasonable period of time, we'll be able to take a look at the data and see if in fact there is greater efficacy in one versus another.
Interesting that this controlled trial is actually testing three therapies against another therapy, not against no therapy. So presumably feeling that these are at least safe enough that they're not doing more harm to these patients who are already at very high risk of death.
You make a very good point there. So ZMAP, even though it did not get beyond the statistically significant cutoff, it was clearly safe. You could not possibly do a placebo-controlled trial now when you have an intervention that you know is safe and that is suggestive of being effective.
We've talked about the violent attacks on aid workers. There's been a lot of mistrust of international health workers and, in particular, the vaccine campaigns. Has that kind of mistrust or violence also impacted the randomized trial of the four different treatments?
Well, the violence and the disruption in society has negatively impacted everything we do. We have been fortunate that the accrual onto our therapeutic trial has not been seriously impacted by the violence, although we had to suspend the trial in one or two treatment units when they were attacked. One of them actually was burned down. Mm-hmm. It didn't, fortunately, interfere with the follow-up of the individuals who were in the trial, but it certainly made it more difficult to conduct it. So the answer to your question is everything about the response in the DRC is being negatively impacted by the disruption in society and by the outright violence that's going on.
Well, Anthony Fauci, are there broader lessons to learn from these two major Ebola outbreaks and the intensive research effort to develop vaccines and treatments for Ebola going forward, looking at other emerging outbreaks or the possibility of other emerging disease outbreaks?
Well, I think that what we've learned, and it really goes beyond learning, it's more a confirmation that there have always been emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases we see them right now currently with Ebola, with Zika, with chikungunya, with all of those other outbreaks that we've experienced. And there will always be emerging outbreaks. The more one encroaches upon the environment and gets into contact with animals that might be harboring these infections, the greater the chance you have of the beginning of an outbreak. And with the incredible amount of travel that occurs throughout the world, it makes it more likely that you'll have widespread of outbreaks. So this is a reality that we have to deal with. One of the things that we've learned from the West Africa outbreak of Ebola and now the DRC outbreak is that you can do ethically sound and scientifically sound clinical research within the setting of an ongoing outbreak. We have really learned a lot, and hopefully with the therapeutic trial, we'll learn even more.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the federal agency where much of the development of Ebola vaccines and treatments is happening. Dr. Fauci, thank you so much.
Good to be with you. My pleasure.
Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. This summer, when you throw a burger on the grill, you have more options than ever before. You could opt for the traditional ground beef burger or any of dozens of veggie burgers, including the Beyond Burger, an advanced plant-based burger that looks and cooks like meat. Soon there may be another option: burgers grown in a lab. Actual muscle cells, meat, cultured in petri dishes rather than a whole cow. And it's not just burgers. Companies are working on products like chicken nuggets and fish sticks, all grown in the lab. But there's a big difference between a burger and a steak, a chicken nugget and an actual chicken breast. And that's where my next guest comes in. Natalie Rubio is a graduate student at Tufts University and a New Harvest Research Fellow. She's written a piece for TheConversation.com about the challenge of growing actual meat. Natalie, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Heather.
Let's start with the basics. Why would we want to eat meat that's grown in a lab instead of, you know, traditional meat that comes from a whole animal?
Yeah, there's a variety of reasons. Definitely the first one that comes to mind, and the reason that I was first really excited about this technology, is the animal welfare aspect. Animals are not raised in the kindest conditions in the large farms where the majority of our meat comes from. So if we can remove the entire sentient animal from the process and just use their cells, which are not sentient, they can't feel pain or emotional distress, it cuts out, you know, most of the ethical concerns with eating meat.
Does it also change the environmental footprint of meat production?
Right. So the other two main motivators are environmental sustainability and then public health. You know, if we think about creating meat this way, a lot of the environmental degradation that is associated with traditional agriculture would be a lot different, like the methane that's produced by cows. If we don't have cows, then we won't have that greenhouse gas emission contribution from the animals. We won't have the same issues with water pollution, with huge areas of land being cultivated to grow crops to feed these animals, way less water use, just because we're using a more streamlined process instead of creating a complex animal and then harvesting specific tissues. We can just grow those specific tissues. And then the third benefit, public health, foodborne illnesses. If we have a different kind of production scenario that's a lot more sterile, a lot more under our control, what microbes are in there or aren't in there, we could, you know, theoretically eliminate foodborne illnesses.
And yet it's very odd to think about meat without there being an animal involved. Is what is grown in the lab really meat?
You know, that's for everyone to decide. What does meat mean to you or to me? You know, if you grew up on a farm and you have that really strong tie to the animals and the land, then cultured meat probably doesn't resonate as meat with you. But most of us, we don't have that tie to animals. We don't see where our food is coming from. And I think if we educate people about what the process looks like, then it's up to every individual to decide if it's for them or not.
When we're talking about cultured meat, we're not talking about a plant-based product, a substitute, though, right? We're talking about actual animal cells grown in a lab. What actually goes into cultured meat?
So exactly, just like if you take a chunk of animal meat and you start to break it down and think about what it's composed of, it's mainly muscle cells, muscle fibers. And then there's also fat tissue in there. And that provides the lipids and the juiciness, the essential fatty acids that we find important for meat. And then there's also connective tissue, the collagen that wraps around the muscle fibers. And then there's also blood vessels that distribute blood and oxygen throughout the tissue. And then after slaughter, it kind of contributes to this taste that is distinctly meaty, because plants don't have blood and don't have these certain elements. So if we looked at what we're making under the microscope, you know, in a few years or decades or whenever it's fully developed, it should look like animal-based meat because it's the same elements there.
Natalie Rubio, your work is in large part trying to make cultured meat more like animal-derived meat. I mean, when you think about all of those different components that are in muscle tissue, in meat, what we've been able to do so far in the lab is emulate something like ground meat, where all those different types of cells are kind of mushed up together in a big lump. And what you're trying to do is get from that to something that might look like a steak or a pork chop, something that's actually structured like a cut of meat. How different is that? How much more do you have to do to get that?
Yeah, it's really, really tricky. It's a fun problem to solve. Basically, the problem, why it's not trivial to grow steak and why it's easier to grow products that look like processed meat, it really all comes down to what vasculature does in the body and how we haven't really figured out how to incorporate a vascular system when we're growing tissues in the lab. So basically, we grow cells, and at a certain point, if you think about like a sphere of cells, for example, the outside of the sphere is being exposed to we call it growth media. It's basically like this soup of nutrients and proteins and vitamins and minerals that we feed our cells. And the outside of the sphere can absorb those nutrients and get access to oxygen. But the middle is blocked off by all the other cells from that nutrition and oxygen. And so those start to die, which is why, you know, our bodies have vascular systems, because we have all these capillaries and arteries and veins that are carrying nutrition and oxygen through our bodies. But in culture, we haven't incorporated that vascular system in our tissues. And so it's hard to get thick tissues. So instead, we have a lot of little thin tissues that we can combine that end up looking like processed meat. So in order to get thicker tissues, but also organized tissues. So if you look at a muscle, that cross-section of what your muscle looks like, all your muscle fibers are aligned. They're pointing in the same direction. It's a very structured tissue. And when we're culturing cells in research, if we're not trying to induce some structure or formation, they'll kind of just grow randomly in different orientations, and it doesn't look like a steak or a pork chop.
And how would you start to get that structure? I mean, is that a chemical signal that you give the cells to line up in a certain direction? Is it physical guidance?
So there's probably a lot of different ways to think about it. What I'm doing and people in my lab are doing is called a scaffold-based approach. So step one is selecting the material that we want to use. So we want to use something that is edible, it's sustainable, It's cost effective and it works well with our cells. Our cells are happy in the environment of the material. We love using things that are plant derived because obviously the goal is to move away from needing animals for this process. So something like cellulose, which is what plant cell walls are made out of. It's in all the vegetables we eat. We could use this material to grow our animal cells on. We could also use something called chitosan, which is a polysaccharide that is found in mushrooms. And then the next step after we select our material is to figure out what form we want it to take. Then the next step is to add the cells to that structure. And then we're looking at how well the cells attach to the material, how well they grow, if they mature into functional skeletal muscle or adipose tissue, and how well we can get the cell and scaffold system to look like meat.
What you're describing also sounds a lot like the challenges facing researchers who are trying to develop, essentially grow organs that could be used for transplantation. How much overlap and crosstalk is there between those two different fields of trying to grow animal organs, essentially, in the lab?
Exactly. Yeah. So cultured meat was kind of born from the medical tissue engineering field, you know, which, like you mentioned, are people who are trying to grow human organs for either disease models. So we could have like a little human kidney that we're doing tests on instead of using animal models, for example, or to have implants. So if someone has a diseased organ, we can grow a human organ rather than needing another human to donate something or to get something from an animal or do an autograft from your own body. So the medical field has been growing and had a lot of different degrees of success depending on what kind of tissue people are trying to grow. And so some very smart people saw that this was happening and thought, hey, this makes sense for food too. You know, meat is an organ basically, so why don't we try these techniques and adapt it for a new application? So basically everything that I do in day-to-day research is inspired by things that people have done for medical-based tissue engineering.
And how far along is this work? I mean, even the cultured burgers that don't have all of this structure are not really on the market. I mean, several years ago, we saw one burger was touted and eaten and had a price tag of something like $325,000. And they haven't really hit the market more broadly yet. So how far away are we from having something like a cultured steak or a cultured pork chop available?
Right. Oh, I would say very, very far. I mean, this is not only is it new technology, but there's not too many people working on it and there's not a lot of funding. Think about how many labs around the world are working on cancer or, you know, these kind of more common research goals. Like there's so much funding and so many people working on it. And really what we're doing in this new world of food innovation is really, really small. And I think maybe because it gets a lot of media attention, because it's very interesting, it might seem like it's a larger field than it is. But we're really at the early stages of just figuring this stuff out. We're trying to answer very basic questions about how animal muscle and fat cells work. And there's not really an infrastructure for us to fit into. There aren't factories that are set up that we can just go, you know, grow this product in. We need to build that all from the ground up. So I assume it'll be a while.
Natalie Rubio is a New Harvest Research Fellow, a graduate student at Tufts University working on cultured meat. She was part of a workshop at MIT this past week, and she's written a piece for theconversation.com. Natalie, thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. CRISPR gene editing. It's gone from an obscure biotech term to a household name in the past few years. in no small part due to a scientist who last year announced that he'd not only modified the DNA of human embryos, but that two baby girls had been born carrying the edits he'd made. CRISPR is not the only way to edit DNA, but it is far faster, easier, and less expensive than alternatives, and that has pushed long-standing debates about human genetic selection and modification into fast forward. On one hand, there's the promise of curing debilitating genetic diseases. On the other hand, there's the fear of designer babies and widespread eugenics. A new documentary called Human Nature explores how we got here and where we might be headed with CRISPR gene editing. Sarah Goodwin is producer and lead science advisor for that film, Human Nature. She's also the executive director of the science outreach nonprofit iBiology. Ron Vail is founder and president of iBiology, and his day job, he is a biology professor at the University of California, San Francisco. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank you.
Sarah, Human Nature starts off telling kind of the origin story of CRISPR gene editing. I mean, it's something that occurs in nature, and you kind of tell the story of how it became a tool for research and possibly medicine and possibly beyond. And one part of that was the role of a company that provides live bacterial cultures for food production, things like making yogurt. Tell us that part of the story.
Yeah, so this part of the story was actually something I learned as well. And I think a lot of people don't know this part of the CRISPR story. But to make yogurt, you need to have active bacteria cultures that need to thrive and survive. And in nature, bacteria also have to kind of fight off different elements that are out there, mostly in the form of viruses called bacteriophage. And so a scientist at Danisco wanted to figure out, you know, is there a way we can figure out how the bacteria and bacteriophage are interacting? Like, why are these bacteria cultures dying? Is there something we can do to make it so this doesn't happen anymore? And he essentially did this through sequencing bacteria that had been exposed to different viruses. And he found that whenever a bacteria had been exposed to a virus bacteriophage, that a piece of that bacteriophage got incorporated into a part of the bacteria genome that had been identified as this thing called a CRISPR array, which was a series of short kind of repeated segments of DNA interspersed with these mystery sequences that people didn't really know where they came from. And Rodoff's work really showed that these mystery sequences that were part of CRISPR were pieces of the invading bacteriophage that was affecting the bacteria. And when that got incorporated, the bacteria became resistant to virus attack. And that eventually kind of had a big clue as to how the CRISPR system worked.
I mean, it's just a fascinating part of the story that I think we haven't heard much, and where the more official or more widespread origin story tends to start is at UC Berkeley in the lab of Jennifer Doudna. And in fact, in the film, you also kind of hint at another step in this process, which was that it was another researcher who kind of brought CRISPR to the attention of Jennifer Doudna. And then she went from there and did the work of describing it in her lab.
Yeah, and I think a big goal of our film was to really show that scientific discoveries come from a lot of different people working in a lot of different areas. I mean, even in the case of Rodoff, he wasn't trying to understand CRISPR. He was trying to understand why some bacteria cultures made good yogurt and why some didn't. And, you know, that was a really important message of this film, because oftentimes science is portrayed as, you know, an individual or a small number of people making a big eureka moment discovery. And we wanted to show that that's not really how it works.
Ron Vail, as a biology researcher, do you remember when you first saw that publication that did come from Jennifer Doudna's lab describing CRISPR, and it ends with a rather prophetic statement about just how powerful a tool the CRISPR system could be turned into? And it feels like that paper has, although it was only several years ago, become almost a, you know, where were you when moment for biologists.
It was. I think I've never seen a phenomena in biology where something just spread like wildfire so quickly in the biology community. You know, I think people very quickly realize, you know, the power of this technology. And I should say, you know, not just for direct therapeutics or engineering, but that technology was applicable for so many things in basic research. It's become a fundamental underpinning of basically all biological research at this point.
You mean as a tool?
As a tool, as a tool. You know, virtually all laboratories working in molecular or cell biology, they may be working on diabetes, they may be working on cancer, they may be working on neurodegenerative disease. It's become such a widespread tool. I think it's very important to understand it's now a technology, it's now a tool, but the original people that worked on CRISPR never imagined it was going to be a tool, never imagined it was going to become the most powerful technology in biology. Before that breakthrough paper, you know, there was well over a decade or more of basic curiosity-driven research, including Jennifer Doudna's original work at Berkeley, did not start off with the intention of developing a technology. It was really trying to understand, you know, how this very interesting system in nature works.
And I think the length of time that that basic research was going on would surprise a lot of people, because by the time CRISPR started to make it into the public eye, into the media, it already had this godlike status of being a technology that could revolutionize all of medicine and, for that matter, human reproduction and evolution. But in the film, Sarah Goodwin, there's a much slower progression to that. Was that a deliberate message?
Yeah, it was. And it was, I mean, it was a risk that we kind of knew we were taking, because we weren't sure would people be interested in this science origin story. But we felt like it was an important thing to try, an important message to get across. And so we really took the time to interview as many of the early CRISPR researchers as we could.
And at one point in the film, you have Jennifer Doudna, this early researcher, talking about recurring nightmares that she started to have, coming face to face with Hitler, wanting to know how CRISPR works. That really seems to highlight, you know, where this public debate has gotten to about the potential benefits and also the potential, you know, almost weaponization, the fear involved around CRISPR. How did you navigate that in this film? I mean, is the goal of the film to scare people? Is it to make people more comfortable with CRISPR?
So in the film, our goal was to, first and foremost, educate people about what CRISPR is and why people are so excited about it as a technology, so people could kind of understand the fundamental way in which it works. So when people talk about using CRISPR in different ways, they have that knowledge to then think about it. And our other goal was really not to have people think one way or the other. We wanted to present different sides of how CRISPR could be used and the pros and the cons and the middle ground, and have people come away being ready to talk about it and wanting to talk about it with their friends and their colleagues and their family, and having conversations about how they feel about it. And I will just say, since you talk about that moment with Jennifer, that another thing we really wanted to show was that scientists care about the implications of their work. You know, it's not that these scientists were just doing their experiments and they just want to move forward no matter what. Like, they're really, you know, Jennifer especially has been very public about being reflective about the technology and what it could be used for and how we all as a society should come together to talk about it.
And I'm curious, after producing this 2-hour deep dive into the story of CRISPR, has it changed how you think about human gene editing?
Yes and no. I mean, I actually had a kid during the production of this, and so I was learning about genetic information about myself and the risks to my, you know, future child while we were having a lot of these conversations with, you know, scientists and people involved in using CRISPR to treat different things. And I think it really made me question, you know, in what case would I consider using CRISPR? And I think the conclusion I came to for myself personally, being lucky in that I don't have a history or knowledge of any like debilitating genetic disease, that I probably would not want to change anything and kind of leave it up to nature to create, you know, whatever my child was going to be.
And Ron, what about you? I mean, you're a scientist who I'm guessing has probably used CRISPR technology in the lab. Did being involved with this film change your thinking about the technology at all?
Well, you know, I think this is a very deep topic that honestly you don't think about a little. It's something that I think our scientists and society are probably going to, you know, grapple with, you know, for the next few decades, honestly. You know, I think what we're trying to do with this film is really just start to open up a conversation that I think needs to be had between scientists, you know, who are involved in technology and a society who can really be well informed of what the technology is, because there's also the danger if it's not explained well, then, you know, the thought process also isn't as productive or as deep. I think an important part of this film that we're trying to do is not just through the film, but also in various engagement venues to get scientists and the public really talking about these issues. And that's going to happen at the Woods Hole Film Festival. So after this film, we're going to have a panel discussion. So I think that will be a great venue for people that come to the film to really, you know, have that film like nucleate a conversation.
That's Ron Vail. He is the founder and president of iBiology. Sarah Goodwin is the executive director of iBiology and producer and lead science advisor for the film Human Nature. It will be screening at the Woods Hole Film Festival later this month and out in select theaters this fall. Up next, poetry in science. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Science and poetry. I happen to love them both, but they're not widely seen as complementary and certainly not overlapping pursuits. My next guest thinks maybe they should be. Elisa New is the Powell M. Cabot Professor of American Literature at Harvard University and creator and host of the TV series Poetry in America. She's been collaborating with the magazine Nautilus on a project called Poetry in Science. Elisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Heather. Delighted to be here.
For Poetry in America, you seek out all sorts of people to talk about poetry. Why specifically seek out scientists to talk about poetry?
Well, the love affair between poetry and science is a really long one. And I think about, say, you know, those poets of the 19th century whose delight in poetry was often nurtured by their ramblings in their local pastures and in their studies in what they would have called natural history, that science and poetry were really complementary and allied pursuits was commonly held for certainly much of American literary history. And so I think of this project and especially this work with Nautilus Magazine as restoring a relationship between poetry and science that somehow has gotten ruptured. Scientists also, so many of them whom I've been able to talk to, are either lovers of poetry or people who bring an attitude of curiosity and observation and patience to the way they look at the world that is very, very much like the attitude that poets bring. They have a kind of attitude that's expressed by the word rather than rushing toward what this all means, what the grand theory is. They have a delight in the small details and in making observations of texture.
Elisa New, in addition to hosting a TV series about poetry and trying to get poetry to a broader audience, you also teach teachers how to teach poetry, if we can get through all the teaching there. And one of the things that you highlight is poetry and problem solving. I mean, we were just talking about the observation part of science and how that is complementary to poetic observation. But talk about poetry and problem solving.
I love that you asked that question. We sometimes think when we read print on a page that we should just let our eyes run along it, move in a linear way from beginning to middle to end, and that somehow a narrative arc will tell us everything we need to know. I think we're conditioned by all the narrative modes that we're exposed to all the time. But reading a poem, that is reading this encoded and distilled, almost like little equation that sits on a page and represents a poet's experience, really is more like looking at a problem and trying to inspect the pieces before one, figuring out how they fit together, thinking about if this word means that, well, then the rest of this stanza will have this inflection. And if this word, on the other hand, means this, well, then that stanza will go in a completely different direction. The pleasure of working that out and sometimes of synthesizing and realizing, well, yes, it might in fact mean both of these things. Dwelling within all of the possibilities of meaning is more like problem solving. And the problem solving that scientists enjoy doing, puzzling over, than like watching an episode of narrative television or reading a really gripping short story.
Absolutely.
I think that putting poetry next to other problem solving activities, you know, like doing a crossword puzzle, it allows us to approach it with more pleasure, more ease than we might if we thought, oh, I just have to read through these lines, start at the beginning, get to the end, and then say what it's about.
I wonder, as you have talked with scientists about poetry, is it the reading of poetry, the decoding of poetry, that problem solving that they enjoy about poetry? Or is it in some cases, obviously, it's also writing poetry, which to me has got to be an even bigger problem-solving puzzle to put together. Is there a common thread about what draws these scientists to poetry?
Last summer at about this time, I sat on the grass of Harvard's Arboretum with two scientists, Ned Friedman, who's the head of the Arboretum and is a scientist who studies trees, and Scott Edwards, who studies birds. And we were in the field. We were in the field with a poem. And understanding this poem was not the work of a day, probably, or of an hour. It was the kind of work to which one would return. So they brought an intellectual pacing to the experience that really stood out for me. But also, scientists often really love when poets get science right. I'll give you an example. Scott Edwards and I read a poem by Emily Dickinson about a robin. She writes of the robin, "You'll know her by her voice. At first, a doubtful tone, a sweet endeavor, but as March to April hurries on, she squanders on your head such arguments of pearl. You beg the robin in your brain to keep the other still." And Scott Edwards has done a lot of research into the songs of robins, and that phrase, arguments of pearl, he was so tickled by it because the discreet tones of a robin's call that one can hear if you slow the robin's call down many, many, many times, you can hear it's almost as though One is listening to these little luminescent pearls on a string. And so Scott just loved how Dickinson was such an observant listener that she really got it right. And there's a much shorter poem by Dickinson I read with Ned Friedman. We read it on a day that there had been a thunderstorm in the Arboretum, and a catalpa tree that was sitting in front of us had basically had its bark blasted off or even steamed off. Lightning had hit the tree. It had set all the moisture, all the sap in the tree to boiling, and the bark had blown off the tree.
Wow.
Which is a pretty dramatic thing to happen. And so we read this poem, and here it goes. Nature sometimes sears a sapling, sometimes scalps a tree. Her green people recollect it when they do not die. Fainter leaves to further seasons dumbly testify. We who have the souls die oftener, not so vitally. The first stanza of this poem in particular, that where the poet says that nature sears a sapling and scalps a tree, is such an uncannily accurate description. I mean, the bark is literally scalped. And as I sat there with Ned Friedman, I could just see he was just overjoyed at the kind of scientific perspicacity of this poet.
Elisa New, I wonder if you could make any recommendations for those who love science, love poetry, and would love to have some reading that blends those two.
Sure. One of my favorite poets is A.R. Ammons, who didn't know that he was going to be a poet. It happened to him somewhat accidentally. He studied science in college, and he was working at his father-in-law's biological glass company, which meant he made lenses for microscopes. And I don't know, he walked along the beach a lot, and he began writing. And he really stands out among American poets because he loved the sound of scientific language, and he loved technical language. And he had a highly spiritual attitude toward, you know, what he really did think of as the wonders of the natural world, a sort of reverence, but a reverence that was only deepened by scientific knowledge. So yes, I would recommend A.R. Ammons. Another poet I love, who always appeals to people who love science, is Marianne Moore, who was one of those modernist poets who had utterly lost patience with sentiment and the poetry of ennobling thoughts and of romantic manipulation. Not interested in that at all. Marianne Moore spent a lot of time in zoos and in museums, and she was fascinated by all kinds of animals, especially the most eccentric ones. And so she wrote poems about giraffes and about elephants and pangolins and ostriches. And what she creates are really like little animals made of words.
Well, thank you for the recommendations. Elisa New is the Powell M. Cabot Professor of American Literature at Harvard University. She's the creator and host of the TV series Poetry in America, and she's collaborating with the magazine Nautilus on a project called Poetry in Science. Elisa, thank you.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed being with you.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.